BBC World Service, this is On the Podium, a show dedicated to the most remarkable stories the Olympics and Paralympics can offer. Me? I'm just a comedian. I'm here for the free soda. But navigating this with me is BBC Athletics commentator Ed Harry and Paralympian Scout Bassett. And I'm Eliza Skinner. Where's my cola? I'm here for cola! Okay, we like to talk about food. If you could only have one chocolate bar for the rest of your, or one kind of chocolate bar. I don't mean one chocolate bar for the rest of your life and you have to make that one bar last. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying one type of chocolate bar. Every time you have a chocolate bar, it's this type of chocolate bar for the rest of your life. What would it be? I know it's a torturous question.
Would you know Cadbury's Whisper Gold? Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Is that caramel inside?
Yeah. So like a Whisper bar, a conventional Whisper bar, which would be second choice, is like tiny, tiny air bubbles, really tiny ones. Not big ones like you get in Aeros, but tiny ones. And a Whisper Gold has got like a layer of caramel as well. So you get Cadbury's caramel, but within a Whisper bar. So I really like those.
It's not really a bar, but it's a candy that comes in package like a bar. The Reese's peanut butter cup.
Oh, yeah, that counts. Yeah,
because there is nothing greater on the planet, the best combo than peanut butter and chocolate. There's no argument there. You can do that anything. Smoothie, desserts, cakes, brownies, whatever. That combo is the best to me.
Regarding Reese's, I like the ratio of peanut butter to chocolate with the minis. Those big ones, it's too much peanut butter.
I don't think there's such a thing.
Really?
I don't think there's such a thing as too much peanut butter. No.
I'm sorry.
No.
Wow.
No, I'm not done with that.
this question makes me sad. Because just thinking of not having all of the whims available. The one that I like really seek out are, again, those holiday single wrapped things, the like Russell Stovers, marshmallow covered in dark chocolate.
Oh, that's a bad take, Liza.
Oh, wow. Scout's so upset
bad
with me.
Take. Marshmallow.
I love it. I don't like milk chocolate. I like dark chocolate. I love marshmallow.
Okay, that's fine. But marshmallow is so gross. I don't even know what that is.
I got so into this one time a few years ago, back at the height of Twitter being a fun place and a place that brands like to be. One night I tweeted something like, I don't know why we're pretending like Godiva is an okay chocolate when obviously Lindt is the best available. And Lindt wrote back and was like, we would like to take you to brunch. Also, we want to send you a package. And they sent me this huge package of just the weirdest chocolate bars and so many of them that for a while, anytime someone would come over I would work with somebody, I'd be like handing out chocolate bars. Like, do you want a chocolate pineapple bar? You want one of these? What do you like? Blueberries? Chocolate blueberries? I got that for you. Here you go.
Wow.
I miss those days when brands were ready to send you their stuff. Right. Best get on with it. Ed, who is joining us on the podium?
Our guest today is a double world and double Commonwealth champion in the 400 meter hurdles. And while injury meant she never really got the chance to be at her best for a Summer Olympic Games, her Olympic adventure didn't end when her track career ended. She took up the bobsled and she went to the Winter Games of 2014, becoming the first Australian summer and winter Olympian. And while she was training for those games in Sochi, she was also beginning the process of qualifying as a medical doctor. Dr. Yana Pittman, welcome to On the Podium.
Thanks, guys. It's really lovely to be with you.
Oh, we're so happy to meet you. We're so happy to have you here. We have some photos that we're going to use to move our discussion along. And let's take a look at the first photo, Ed. What do we have?
I'm looking at a picture of you doing your lap of honor after winning your first World Championship gold medal. So it's Paris, it's 2003. I know it's the lap of honor because you're clearly shouting or screaming something. You're holding the flag behind your head. I can see your sunglasses perched on the top of your head as well. You look strong. You look like someone who has just conquered the world, because that's what you have done. But we've got so many pictures to look at of you. We've also got the bobsled covered in the Australia livery from 2014. I mean, it's a career in two parts. For you, what is the sporting achievement that you are most proud of?
That's a hard first one, Ed. Look, that World Championships you mentioned in Paris was a massive highlight because it was quite early in my athletics career. So I was only 20, 21 years of age, so I wasn't expected to win that race. And the Russian athlete, Yulia Pechonkina, had just broken the world record a couple of weeks before that event. So, look, we were definitely hoping for a medal, don't get me wrong. But I remember crossing the finishing line and my heart going, oh, my God, I think I've just won. Like, it was a very surreal experience. But in terms of the race I enjoyed most, it would actually be fast forward to my second world title, mainly because I had just had a baby 7 months beforehand. So my perspective on life had changed dramatically. And to see what the woman's body can do to come back from birth and training through pregnancy and things like that was amazing. And the pressure was a little bit more on there. I think most people sort of said, oh, you know, realistically, after having a baby, you're not going to be able to run very fast. But the times that year had indicated that I could win. So it was amazing to do both, to go in as the underdog with no expectations and win in Paris, but then come back, you know, a couple of years later and then win when the expectations were high and people, you know, they were expecting you to win in that context.
You said your perspective had changed so much after becoming a mother. What was that change?
Priorities change, don't they? Like, you know, I wanted to win. You know, that angry hunger within an athlete's body, you guys know that. It doesn't go anywhere. I remember standing on the start line and thinking, look, if it doesn't happen, I've got a 7-month-old to go home to and give a cuddle who doesn't care whether I've won or not. Internally took the pressure off, even though the extrinsic pressure was there from the Australian public and things like that. It was also a great year of training. I spent a lot of time with Paula Radcliffe, who many of you will know, also won the New York Marathon that year after having a baby. And we really talked a lot about pregnancy and fitness and how to get your body back after, you know, that experience and the natural EPO levels that come from pregnancy and training and learning a lot about what your body is capable of. So, yeah, I think having that child just made me realize there's a lot more to life than just sport.
I have not had a child myself, but I have heard from my many friends who have that the idea of getting your body back is not really an accurate way to describe that journey. Is it?
Back then, Eliza, it was different. Like, people really looked at you oddly when you were running on the track at 6 months pregnant. You know, I've got footage of me hurt when I was 7 months pregnant. And some of the comments that people would give you were like, what are you doing? You know, this is ridiculous. You're going to hurt your baby. And it's very different now that Serena Williams and a lot of the athletes come out and globally have lots of children. But back in that era, you know, you lost contracts because people assumed you wouldn't come back to the sport and, you know, and just very much doubted that you knew what you were doing. And even my sports doctor, I remember ringing them and saying, you know, what level can I train to? And they're like, oh, don't ask me. So, but you're right. It wasn't really getting your body back, because if you train well and you maintain your fitness through pregnancy, then it really just continued. It was just like, drop a baby and wait a couple of weeks, you feel okay and start again.
You mentioned something about how you received so much criticism publicly after not being able to compete in Beijing with an injury. And I feel like as women athletes, the kind of criticism that as a woman you get is so different, and most stuff that men never have to deal with being an athlete. You know, how did you navigate that and the pressure of deal with that?
That's true, Scout. And to be honest, I had a lot of negative media in my early career as a sports person. I've always worn my heart on my sleeve, and therefore, you know, even when I was younger, so if I was quite a dramatic, emotional athlete, for example, so therefore I wouldn't hold back if something really hurt. I'm not political. I really don't jump onto difficult conversations. It's more that I believe in honesty about yourself. When you lose an Olympics, when an injury comes about, or, you know, even as a woman, if you have a miscarriage or you lose a contract, that you let the emotion out at the time that it happens. So, you know, I'm definitely prone to a good cry in the toilets after a bad race. But I feel like then the very next day, that emotion's gone. I'm not carrying the pain and the negativity for weeks and weeks and weeks. And that's something that once I used to think was a weakness, I now strongly believe is one of my greatest strengths, to let go of negativity in the past.
We have guests on this program who have the movie arc where maybe it went badly at one Olympics, but then years later, maybe not even the next Olympics, they get their medal or their gold medal eventually. You won so many things. And I was lucky enough, I was just starting out covering track and field for the BBC. And I was there in Melbourne when you won your second Commonwealth title. You won it in front of an Aussie crowd. It was just magical.
I know.
But around the Olympic Games, injuries meant it never happened for you. How hard was that to deal with at the time? And even now, looking back, why wouldn't fate let me be fit to do it on the Olympic stage?
Oh, Ed, at the time, it was absolutely heartbreaking. you trained for 4 years, and I guess, as you said, I won everything else, and they were just the wrong years. So how have I won? I won 2003 and 2007 World Championships. Had it just been 1 year later, I would have been double Olympic champion, being 2004 and 2008. Fast forward 10, 15 years, I don't even reckon I would have become a doctor. So I reckon I would have sat on my laurels and, you know, been the Olympic champion, done the commentary pathway here in Australia. But I saw it as a failure, obviously, at the Olympic level. It drove me to open lots of other doors and try and find success in other levels, which I definitely wouldn't have done otherwise.
Speaking of opening other doors, I think that a lot of people, myself included, as a non-athlete, and this is, you know, not my world, but I would expect someone from Australia to be good at track and field. That would make sense. Bobsled, though.
Well, I think, look, I knew athletics wasn't going to happen anymore. You know, I'd lost again another Olympics, 2012 Olympics. I had an Achilles injury again. So I knew my body was expiring on that front. And I wasn't, you know, to me, going to an Olympics in athletics and making the final was no longer something I was interested in. It was either medals or nothing. So I thought, why don't you go to a different Olympics where you get to smell the roses and genuinely realize how privileged you are to be an Olympic athlete, to be able to, you know, really suck up that experience and it be a positive one, because we were never going to win, let's be real.
How enjoyable was it after all those years of just being responsible for yourself to be in a pair, to have like a team atmosphere, which you just don't get in most track and field?
Amazing. Actually, it's twofold. It's yes, it's in terms of the bobsled itself. It was just so nice to have someone to go into the call room with, to share the ups and downs of the experience with. And, you know, we were great friends. We'd known each other for 15 years. So it was almost like doing it with my sister, which was amazing. And funnily enough, she's a veterinary surgeon as well. So we're both complete nerds and in a dangerous sport where you can break your brain. But the other thing that was beautiful about the Winter Olympics was the team camaraderie. So when you get to the Olympic Games, often in the Summer Olympics, the track and field teams stay on their own. You know, the swimming stay by themselves and the netball, well, you know, the different sports kind of keep to themselves. But in Winter Olympics, there's only 55, 60 at a max. I think there's only 43 in the Australian team this Olympics, actually. So you all get to know each other really well. You trained with these athletes and you got to live around brilliance all the time, but different from athletics. So very different characters where they're, I guess, because it's fun. A lot of the sport they do in the winter is a lot of fun rather than running around a track and jumping over things. But it was so vastly different, the experience. I definitely like bobsled more, yes, I have to be honest.
Earlier you were talking about your processing emotions as they come as an athlete, crying in the bathroom. And it just reminded me, I'm a comedian and a writer, and I feel like there have been so many discussions about life in the workplace, about like, don't cry in the workplace, and we had to like work like men. And people are now, I think, trying to find more ways to balance that, like bring your femininity to what it is you do. And it sounds like you've been doing that in a number of different ways. Yeah, for your whole athletic career. Does that feel like the same sort of like a familiar struggle situation?
I think so many women, we put so much pressure on ourselves. And I think, look, don't say to men. Men find it very difficult to express their emotions, and it's often what holds us back. I think probably because of COVID as well, and people are trying to be more compassionate towards others.
And yeah, even with the toxic masculinity, men having issues, I feel like it's still vilifying femininity. And it's just very inspiring to see you exhibit such strength through femininity. I mean, training pregnant, you can't get more strong and feminine than that.
Yeah, I'm trying to lead by example. You know, we talk about bias and women's inequality and things, and ultimately a lot of it is stemmed in our own beliefs and attitudes and opinions around what we should or shouldn't be able to do. And I guess one of the biggest things I have still here in Australia is, you know, I'm a qualified doctor. I work full time, and I'm going to have six children, be working full time. I'm doing research and training and motivational speeches and things like that. And you often get people who say, well, how? And my simple answer is, well, why not? So, you know, you've got to have the right setup in place. But if it's something you dream about, why not be a leader to show other women, you know, young women, what opportunities lie for them to break that gender stereotype around what a woman's capable of, or, you know, should be doing with her life. And that'll only happen with time. And then you will have big changes in what women can achieve, just because that general opinion coming from us within has changed.
Sorry. Like I could do it all. Oh, but I want a nap halfway through some of that.
It can be. I say you can have it all. You just can't have it all at once. So it's just a matter of balancing your goals and working out which ones have your priority at the time.
When did the calling towards medicine start? Because it's not maybe that unusual for sports people to take an interest in what's the physio doing to me? Maybe I'll learn about that when I retire, or maybe I'll become a coach. So I want to know about this. But we're not talking about that, are we? What did you want to specialize in? And when did you first start thinking, this is what I actually want to do with my life?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I wanted to be a doctor long before I wanted to be an athlete. Sport almost got in the way of that. It's always been medicine for me. But no, right, not physio, not orthopedic surgery, not sports medicine. I like to deliver babies and get people pregnant. So, yeah, it's all women's health medicine for me. I love, you know, being in that birth unit with that woman who first-time mums, and, you know, and also just watching the incredible look on the father when they meet their child, and the hard times too. You know, we have obviously women who lose babies and late-term miscarriages and things, and to be a part of someone's world during that time is incredibly precious, and very much more rewarding than sport was. Don't get me wrong, I loved running around, being, you know, an advocate for Australia and running the Olympics is incredible, but the day-to-day satisfaction is far higher in medicine.
I've just realized we have not checked in with our photos in quite a while. We've had so much fun talking to you. What's our next photo, Ed?
This is a family shot. This is you with your children. I can 1, 2, 3, 4
My current family.
We've got to see, about to be added to, because as we're having this conversation, you're very, very pregnant, and we're hoping to get to the end of this podcast before the next one arrives.
Yeah.
you began to have your children during your athletics career, and at the time that was seen as unusual, and thankfully these days it is seen as far more usual and something that there's now an expectation. It's not unusual, which is brilliant. We've reached that place. What do they make of the life that you have had, and how much do they know about it? Do they watch old footage of you running? How do they know mummy, the athlete, and summer and winter Olympics and all the rest of it?
No idea that mummy was an athlete. So my son, yes, my 15-year-old son, he came to the winter games, and he came to some of the late part of my athletics career. So he was very aware. And I remember actually we were in a line one time, maybe 10 years ago, it was only like 5 or 6. And he's like, can we go to the front, mummy? I don't want to wait. Can you just tell them you're famous and can you move to the front? I'm like, buddy, it doesn't work like that. No idea why. But last year I did, I think you have it over, it's definitely over in the UK as well. I'm not sure in the US, but we had that SAS Australia show. So it's a big, you know, where they throw 18 celebrities into an SAS style training course and see who can survive. And I did that, and the girls are old enough to know that mummy did very well. And so they were reenacting everything I did, like pretending to fight each other and, you know, things like that. So from that point, yes, they've worked out that mummy's, you know, does some interesting things. And it's funny though, one of the highlights of my last couple of months was my beautiful daughter. We were having a coffee together, because I try to have coffee with them individually to give them that one-on-one time. And I said, so, buddy, what do you want to do when you grow up? And she says, I want to be Olympic. So not an Olympian, just Olympic. A doctor and a cleaner on the moon.
Is the moon dirty? I have not been made aware of this. Okay.
I don't know. I don't know where she got it from, but to me, I look and I think, well, that little kid thinks she can do anything. Like, she literally feels like, firstly, it made me feel better that she's not as impacted by how much I work as I thought she was, because she still wants to be a doctor. But that she just believes she can do anything. So, you know, family is very important to me. Always has been since I was young. Always wanted lots of kids. Had quite a few miscarriages along the way, which is probably why the desire to have children was so strong, and also the interest in women's health. But yeah, it's pretty special to have kids that are, I guess, aware now that mummy might be a little bit special.
You were speaking about the how far we've come in terms of women in sport and expressing emotion in it, but I feel like there's probably still more that could be done, and I was wondering what you think still needs to be done.
Well, it'd be interesting to hear your opinions on it, to be honest. I mean, coming from a comedian background and also media, and, you know, I was trying to be real and having great role models out there where women are funny and can laugh about themselves, laugh about others, have a thick skin, but then also in the same context show that raw emotion and show that they are human, which I think is definitely happening, but needs to be further progressed. So there just needs to be more people out there that are prepared to put their heart on the line, because the media can be rough, particularly in certain countries. I think the UK and Australia are probably two of the harshest media environments around, and it's learning to be okay with that.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, being seen, just people being able to see people being different and existing and not having that be a huge deal.
That's right. I think, and that's where it'll change if we can continue that. But that's okay and that's allowed. And don't get me wrong, some people won't want to. I have quite a few young friends who just wouldn't be able to be honest and put themselves out there in terms of their fear of being judged. And that I had that as a young person too. I mean, ultimately, none of us wake up in the morning and go, hey, guys, I don't want to be liked today, so I'm going to go do something incredibly stupid to be on the front page of the news and be disliked by my country. I don't know anyone who's that narcissistic or stupid to do something like that. So majority of young athletes just make mistakes in some of the things they say, and we as a public now just need to be a bit more gentle with them. And, you know, there's been a lot of focus internationally on mental health in sport and tennis and gymnastics and things around the world, and I think that's a great start, is that these people are openly talking about some of the things that impact them. And it's great for people who aren't sport at all, because they watch these incredibly successful people open up about what they're going through. And what an amazing thing to be sitting on your couch at home and go, I don't feel too good today, but look, there's Lauren Jackson talking about the issues she had when she was an incredible international women's basketballer, and hey, I'm actually normal.
Yeah, it does seem like the need to have a veneer and a perfect image is not as important anymore. Yeah, that's
thank goodness.
Yeah.
People forget that even though you're a professional athlete or an elite athlete, you're a human being first and foremost. And so a lot of the times, you know, people will have no idea what some of these athletes are going through in their personal lives that could be affecting how they're feeling or thinking mentally or emotionally.
It's even more than that, Scout, because if you think about the type of people that go into sport, you know, we are the A-type personalities, the harshest of the harsh on your performance, constantly judging yourself internally, let alone all the external judgment. And so they're even more prone to having that, feeling vulnerable in those settings. So it's incredibly important that we can have that.
Listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. Our guest is Australia's hurdle hero, Dr. Yana Pittman.
You know, I don't know if this is too personal, but one of the things I thought was really fascinating about your story is that you were coached by your husband, who was both at the time both your husband and your coach. And I'm just intrigued by that relationship and that dynamic. I mean, also another thing you kind of had to manage or balance, and what that was like.
It was horrible.
Oh, okay. It didn't work out well.
No, I don't mind. He was a great athlete himself before he started coaching me. So he ran for the UK. He was a Commonwealth gold medalist as well in the same event as mine. So his knowledge was extraordinary. A lot of athlete relationships fall apart when they're coached by their partner, mainly because you take it all home. So, you know, I was still quite young when he was coaching me. I was always very emotive, and he was the opposite. He was a very strong, stoic man who didn't like emotion. So I start crying, he gets angry. So it's kind of like, oh, this is not going to work very well. But I've seen it work brilliantly in other cases. So another Australian is Debbie Flintoff-King. She's a 1988 Olympic gold medalist. She was coached by Phil King, which is her husband, who then became my coach. And so it was very interesting to see that their marriage thrived through that experience, because she was quite a gentle soul, and he was a very strong, he was a PE teacher, so a sports teacher here in Australia, and lifted her up so beautifully that it worked. It was one of the reasons she won the Olympic gold medal. So it's not that it can't work. I just think it requires a lot of communication. Certainly in my context, Chris was an incredible coach. Like, his knowledge of the event was amazing. His ability to work with a woman of emotion and periods and menstruation, all the different things that come with being a woman, was harder for him. I mean, don't get me wrong, we still won the world title together, and the Commonwealth title together. So we had some great success as a couple. But I definitely think it was one of the reasons our marriage fell apart.
I imagine it must be hard to have the person who's pushing you to, you know, excellence also is supposed to be the person who's comforting you when you take a break from it at the end of the day.
And I think that's what happened, Liza. Like, I can vividly remember Paris Golden League 1 year. I didn't execute the race that I needed to execute, and I just didn't do what he asked me to do. And afterwards, all I wanted was a cuddle from my husband. But he'd got on the bus and gone back to the hotel to you know, break down the race that I'd done and what had gone wrong. And I'm like, mate, I need a cuddle, please. But, whereas he's like, no, I want to work out what the issue is and how can we fix it? The Olympics are a couple of months away. We need to fix it. So, yeah, definitely a challenge.
Ed, do we want to look at another photo?
There is a very happy lady I'm seeing here. I think she sat in a coffee bar or in a restaurant, an older lady, and she's got a drink. Is this mum? And if it is, what's the role that she's played in all of this?
Oh, my mother is extraordinary. So her name's Jackie, and she has been my greatest fan and supporter my entire life. So from, you know, picking up the pieces when I was a little kid to driving me from training every single from school. So she'd pick me up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and literally be my taxi because training was about an hour away. And she hates sport, just to put it out there. Can you imagine not even wanting to? And so she would sit there with her Mills and Boone book, not watching me train. But every day of the week, like I look back on it now and as a mum myself, realizing the commitment she gave to me back as a young athlete is extraordinary. Yeah, so she's been hats off the greatest supporter I've had. And then into life as well, you know, she became my nanny when we travelled overseas. She'd leave my dad back in Australia, which was hard on him, for 3 months and travel with me with Cornelis when I was competing overseas, and she'd do that, you know, all the time. And then when I had more and more babies during medical school, she'd be the one to pick them up from school and look after them for me. And I had the girl, you may not know this, but I had the girls by myself actually as a single mum, and she was the one who, and I think that's what the photos that you've got is her and I sitting there rehashing the decision we made to have the girls solo. So it's a big deal. I mean, I don't know how often it happens overseas, but it's starting to happen a little more here in Australia, where women who are career focused get to the, you know, late 30s and think, I haven't had children yet, I don't want to miss out on that. And sorry, Ed, you don't have a womb, but we do. So therefore we can borrow some sperm from someone and still have babies on our own, which is, you know, 30, 40 years ago was unheard of, but it was a big decision. My family's quite Christian, so it was a long conversation over a long hot coffee mm-hmm. and a block of chocolate. So I'm assuming that's the photo you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. I think it is. Yeah, it's not, it is happening more, but it's non-traditional.
But I've never been traditional. I've always been a mom.
It doesn't sound like it. So if you had, your mother wasn't interested in athletics, you had a plan to be a doctor. How did you find your way into sport in the first place then? What grabbed you about it?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I was always very good as a little kid, let's be honest. So, you know, in Australia, I don't know what it is overseas, but it's compulsory to do athletics at school. So, no, you run the 100 metres and you win by 30. The PE teacher pulls you over and goes, I think you might need to consider doing some sport. Yeah, so, and one of the other big things was, as you probably will realise, both my parents feature quite heavily. My father is a workaholic, a bit like me. He would work Christmas Day. You know, he's an engineer builder, and he would often just sneak out after lunch and go back and keep working on the building site. But he'd take all day off to watch me compete. So I wanted his attention as a young kid. And so if I made the regions, district, state, nationals, he would take a day off to come and be with me. So that was an incentive. And then, you know, I was a bit of a shy, dorky, quirky kid. And all of a sudden you get some of the positive accolades and people saying, wow, you're really good at this. And I hadn't heard that before. So it was, yeah, I guess around 14, 15, I enjoyed the positivity that came from it.
Yeah, being good at something sort of naturally. It's yeah. Like, wow, what would happen if I put some effort into this?
Exactly. And that's all I did. So I remember I was running well, and then I joined Melinda Gainsford's group, and then 6 months later I made the Olympic Games when I was 16. So it was like,
wow.
But I'm huge, Eliza. Like I'm a big woman, very strong, very fast, powerful. Every sport I've tried, I've loved. So I tried boxing, I've tried rowing, cycling, and then obviously bobsled. So it was, I had good opportunities in all of them. So it was, I'm just built for sport, naturally.
We tend to ask a question along the lines of, to most of our guests, what are you going to do next? But you're kind of doing next now. More motherhood. You're a junior doctor, and I bet you still get asked to speak and, like you say, motivational speaking and things. And I know you're a strong advocate for women to be aware of things like cervical cancer, for example. You have such a full life. What are the things you're really passionate about now that you want to be part of your life going forward?
The advocacy stuff's massive, Ed. I really love, and I guess because I was a bit of, not controversial, but I was very honest as a young person, I can talk about women's issues that don't often get talked about. So I know this is one you probably don't want to talk about because it's a sports show, but like women's incontinence postpartum and things like that. So I openly discussed that on national television last year, which instigated an enormous discussion here in Australia with who have gone through that and go through it on a daily basis. And it was something that I don't think anyone's ever talked about in the global media before, openly and honestly about themselves. So I want that position. I want to be able to use my experiences, good and bad, to help other women cope with their bodies and strive for excellence in, you know, with family. So that's a big role that I want to do. I also want to do a lot of research. So I've just started my PhD last year. I'm in my second year of my PhD. So I think my most of my career will now be in medicine, but I will use some of my sporting image to allow me to break molds and barriers and open conversations that probably wouldn't happen if I didn't.
I can't help but think you've chosen a type of medicine that is sort of a natural athletic event almost for the body. Like, it's this amazing thing that a body goes through that, yeah, sometimes you have some injury walking away from it. So you could definitely talk about incontinence postpartum on our sports podcast.
You never know. It was during the SAS show last year. And I was trying really, really, it was only 5.5 months after having another baby. I have lots of them, as you know. And I lost control of my bladder, and I had the choice in that moment to say nothing and just hide it, because I could have very easily got away with it. And I made the executive decision as a gyne to openly say, oh my God, I've just had an accident. And it became viral media here in Australia because people don't talk about that situation. And the reason I did it actually, which was, I think that's a little bit interesting for your show, is it happened to me at the World Championships in 2007 when I won the gold medal as well. And I knew it was going to, and thankfully it was really hot, so I poured water all over my body so that it wouldn't be obvious. But I knew, so if you could look back at the footage, and I'm like, I'm literally pouring water all over my crutch, like just everywhere. Because I was so ashamed that, and I look at it and I think, why would you be ashamed? You've just had a baby 7 months before. You've come up and pulled off a minor miracle by winning the world title so close to the event. But yet that shame was still there. And it wasn't until I did an event back here in Australia, I was speaking at this event, that I admitted it on stage. I said, it happens when you're a woman and you're racing. And a lady came up to me afterwards and said she remembered watching me and looking at that event where I won the world so close to having a baby and feeling so bad about herself that she hadn't got her body even out for the gym yet, that I was almost polarizing women by doing so well, so close to having a child. So I therefore made the decision on the show last year to do the opposite. So let's be honest about our bodies and that we're not capable of coming back that quickly and that we do need to give yourself time. So, and it's the same in sport. You know, a lot of the other athletes who have gone back after having babies pretty quickly have similar issues, and it's all about just getting the right advice from a good physiotherapist and taking time, because your body's remarkably good at bouncing back if you want to go back to sport post-babies.
Not being scared to ask for help.
Exactly. But also to make sure that women back home, our fans, don't look at that and feel alienated by what we're doing. You know, we think women look at us after racing and going straight back to, sorry, after having a baby and going back to racing and think it's awesome. But it also has the opposite effect. They sit there and go, crap, I can't do that. What's wrong with me? And that's the last thing you want someone back home who's supported you all your career to feel that vulnerability in themselves.
Is there any topic or issue that you see currently that you would like to see more discussion on or change with, in particular with women in sport?
Yeah, I think we're doing a really good job. The last couple of years we talk openly about a lot of things in women's sport. You know, we still do have issues. I think Alison Felix brought it up last year when she lost a Nike contract due to having a child, and she was incredibly well supported by the media, and obviously has now got her own company, and those conversations still need to be had, but it's happening, Scout. Like, it's not that it's not, it's we just need to keep having them. The doors are opening. You know, there's lots of other things happening in sport too around, you know, gender, and probably one of the areas I don't have enough knowledge to talk about with you guys, but around the whole XY, XX conversation and how that's going to play out in sport over the next few years is something that's going to be really challenging for all of us, you two, Ed, in the media, because it's going to be a scenario we have to decide what that's going to look like. And it's polarizing in the community, because some of us, I know as an athlete, it's hard to make that decision of running against someone who genetically will be always superior to you. But then I work every day with gender-affirming surgery and gynecology and women's health, and I see how much the opportunity needs to be given to them. So those kind of conversations will also change the platform of sport over the next few years, and need to be openly discussed by us so that we can get to a point where it's fair for everyone.
My big question here is, what do you do to relax, and do you ever relax?
It's a good question.
Because you've got so much energy. You get so much done.
I do, but I'm a big Netflix watcher. And the trick is knowing when you're down and you need a break. So I not someone who'll push through that. I'm very good at identifying when I've had a day when I'm like, today is a day I'm doing nothing. And I will address that straight away rather than let it bottle up and take weeks. And then by the time you end up burning out and fatigue, you need a month off. So, you know, I'm very much on my couple of shows every couple of days of Netflix. And my downtime is with the children. And active, like we'll go for lovely long bushwalks. I love going out and I just literally carry one on the back, one on the front, and the bigger kids walk. And we just go off in the bush and take a picnic. And that's the downtime. Be with your kids, but still stay active.
Do you have any current things you're binging on or recommendations?
I love anything medical.
Makes sense.
Well, it has been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time and brain. And we've had a great time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for including me. It's an honor.
Well, I feel very lazy.
Yes.
So impressive.
Yes.
She does so much. She's lived like 9 lives. She's a cat.
What I really like is because she's Yana Pittman, because she has this platform that she worked so hard to get with all her achievements. Yeah, I'll go on that TV show. And when something happens to me, I'll talk about it. Or I'll sit on a couch in a studio. And because I'm me and I'm known for raising things which people think most people don't talk about, I'm going to do it. Because I've always done it. So being aware of the platform that she has, but doing all of that anyway, when there isn't a camera or somebody with a reporter's notebook, just doing it every day in the job that she does now.
And like she was saying, like showing her honest self, the person that she is every day on that platform. I liked how mindful also she was of the impact that she was having on other women. And not only inspiring them, but making sure to not let them feel any shame or comparison in a negative way.
Ed, I'm curious because she was competing before I was in track but you know, I know while she wasn't the first athlete to have a child and to compete at that elite level.
I feel like a lot of men have. But it doesn't do as much, you know, to the body.
When she was sort of at her peak, was that a big deal? I mean, to come back 7 months after having a baby and to win the world title? I mean, I would just imagine that would have been pretty big news or a big deal then.
It was, and it was big news as well. She mentioned her friendship with Paula Radcliffe, who was doing something similar. What I definitely feel is that now it would be even bigger news. There was a huge story that built around Alison Felix ahead of the Tokyo Olympic Games that she had begun a family and she was coming back, and this great athlete was back for one more Olympics. And Felix had this dispute with Nike. Not a dispute. She'd called them out. They'd taken away her sponsorship. She'd used her platform and Nike had to backtrack and change its policies. It was something we were aware of. And it's something I think we were talking about coming into the 2007 World Championships. But it was, I think it didn't have the prominence in 2007 that it would have commanded now. And that's another change. She talked about how things have changed and what still needs to change. I think it would have been because the athlete can only talk about it if they get asked about it. Because in 2007, yeah, we've got some social media, but we've not got what we've got now.
Absolute madness.
Yeah. A long time ago, you should write things down on bits of paper back then, all that sort of thing. But yeah, I she didn't do it for any reason other than I want to start a family and I want to run and I want to do both things. So I'm going to do both things. It would have been, I think, great if it had had more prominence at the time. And it's fantastic now to be able to talk about it now all these years later and which is just one part of, yeah, the kind of life that makes me feel like, what did I do today? Definitely, Eliza. I'm definitely getting that feeling quite strongly. Incredible.
Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
I was definitely the weirdo. And kids appreciate being weird, especially in middle and high school. It will make your life so much easier as an adult.
Embrace it.
Because, like, I'd be doing drills in the hallway, and they're like, yo, are you a ballerina? Like, what are you doing? What? Like, this is not PE. But, yeah. Just doing different things just to try and make myself better every day, though. being weird.
Raven Saunders, the only athlete to protest on the podium in Tokyo. Next time.